Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topics on this edition of the program: causes and consequences of Russia's behavior in Ukraine, and the role and impact of social media in protest movements. Our guest, Joshua Tucker. He's a professor of politics and Russian and Slavic studies at New York University and a co-director of the NYU Social Media and Political Participation Laboratory. And we're coming to you from his office on the campus of NYU. Joshua is an expert on comparative politics with an emphasis on mass political behavior in Eastern and Central Europe and the former Soviet Union, including elections and voting, public opinion formation, and mass protest. Joshua also analyzes how social media facilitates all forms of political participation. We'll examine Russia's intervention in Ukraine and look at how social media is transforming protest movements from Ukraine to Turkey to Venezuela. Joshua Tucker, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And thanks again for hosting us here in your office. Joshua, first, let's take a look at the referendum in Crimea. I'd like you to put your Russian and Slavic studies hat on to help us understand the ramifications of the referendum, which apparently only Syria, North Korea, and Venezuela have recognized. What factors do you think led Vladimir Putin to this point?
I think we need to think about a variety of different factors that could be out there that could have led him to this point. And I think at the end of the day, which of these interpretations you think are the correct interpretations has an implication on what we think comes next. I think the simplest way to start thinking about distinctions here is whether Putin is generally being driven here by international concerns or security concerns, or Putin has been driven primarily by domestic politics concerns in Russia. The simplest to start with is the security concerns. One way of looking at this, and one way that people have posited, is that in the aftermath of the Euromaidan protests, which led to the Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych, fleeing the country, that the Russians looked at this situation and saw a genuine security threat, and in particular were worried either maybe very specifically about the fate of the Black Sea fleet and Russia's continued access to the Black Sea, or maybe more generally about what the long-term ramifications would look like of Russia losing an ally right on its border, and then wondering if Russia does nothing about this, what message does this send in the future? So that's sort of one security concern way of looking at it. The other way that people have been throwing out and talking about is whether or not this is part of a larger movement on the part of Putin, trying to think about Russia's future and Russia's place in the world. Now, a lot of people who are subscribing to what could be loosely called the Greater Russia approach to Putin's thinking point to a 2005 speech that Putin made where he called — the language is a little bit in dispute — but where he essentially referred to the breakup of the Soviet Union as one of the great tragedies of the 21st century. If you take this vantage point, then you have a picture of Putin who sort of, as leader, is motivated perhaps for his legacy, perhaps for believing that this is what is in long-term Russia's security interests, in the idea that Putin wants to, in some way, shape, or form, restore Russia to its prior greatness. Now, I don't think many people think that this involves a full-scale reconstitution of the former Soviet Union. However, people have suggested that what this may mean is that when opportunities present themselves in order to address the situation, especially if places where there are large numbers of Russians living, Putin will take the opportunity because he sees this in sort of Russia's long-term interests. So from this vantage point, this is a very different approach to thinking about what's happening in Crimea in terms of a reaction to a specific security situation that developed because of a specific incident that happened in Ukraine. This is a more longer range plan. This is a more longer term. And here the picture is of Russia as being opportunistic, as taking advantage of a situation to advance a longer term plan. So those are sort of two frameworks based heavily in the security sphere. The alternative is to think about this more in terms of Russian domestic politics. And here there's sort of two issues that might be tantamount. The first one is to think about Putin's situation after the most recent election cycle. This is when Putin returned to the presidency. And in Russia, the parliamentary elections are held before the presidential elections. And following the parlamentary elections in Russia in December of 2011, large-scale protests broke out in Moscow over issues of electoral fraud, protests that resembled the types of protests that had happened in 2004, say, in Ukraine in the Orange Revolution. This was sort of the first large-scale protest of this kind that we had seen in Russia under Putin's rule, and especially of this magnitude that we had seen in Moscow. And it's been argued that in the aftermath of these protests, Putin decided that he was going to take a turn to the right and try to embrace a more sort of nationalistic and conservative constituency within Russia, essentially giving up on the kind of middle-class liberals in Russia who many say form the bulk of the protests. On the other hand, it may also have reflected a recognition of the fact that a number of people involved in the protests were also nationalists, and an idea that this is a group that could be appealed to. From this vantage point, Crimea then is an opportunity to show to more nationalistic Russians and more conservative Russians, because Crimea has a particularly strong tie to the Orthodox Russian Church, that Putin is hearing their demands and he's acting on their behalf. So this may be a case where we look at this and say, okay, based on the constituency he has in Russia today, this should be fairly popular. And sure enough, in the short term, Putin has seen increase in his popularity rankings across numerous polls and surveys. At the same time, though, that's a common phenomenon that we see when countries get involved in international conflicts. We call it in political science a sort of rally around the flag effect. And we don't know how long this is going to last. So this would be a third way of thinking about what's going on.
Joshua, to follow up, you talked about he takes advantage of opportunities that present themselves. At the same time, he himself manufactures situations. For example, he actually fomented much of the trouble in Crimea, not to say that there weren't Russian speakers who were obviously interested in going back, so to speak, to Russia. But how do you view that? And what about the aftermath of what we just saw? Is the annexing of Crimea the last step or the first step on a slippery slope whereby Russia is going to be interested in eastern Ukraine? Because Ukraine, some analysts have said, is very personal to Putin. It's really something that he has always considered part of sort of greater Russia. So this is really a battleground.
Well, honestly, I don't know the answer to that question, and I'm not going to pretend to know the answer to the question. But I think that's why it's useful to begin thinking through these things in terms of what we think the ultimate motivation is. If the ultimate motivation was really about a fear, a security concern, after the change of government in Ukraine, revolving around the Black Sea Fleet, that's something that can be assuaged, right? There, one might think that there are ways, and that may or may not include Crimea joining Russia, but there are ways that Russia's interests could be mollified in that particular regard.
I just want to interrupt briefly because this leads me to ask you, again, we saw in the referendum, there was an either or, either Crimea becomes part of Russia or it goes back to some kind of 1992 constitution. There was never an option to remain within Ukraine. And President Obama, European leaders criticized Putin for not talking, trying to dialogue with the government. But he, of course, considers this government a renegade government in Ukraine. He doesn't see their legitimacy. At the same time, now, after this referendum, Russia is forced to talk with Ukraine because Crimea is dependent on Ukraine for water, electricity, a number of things. So whether he likes it or not, there's going to have to be dialogue. And what I'm getting to is the fact that had he talked to the leaders, presumably they could have worked out a modus vivendi. Again, this goes back to what I've heard analysts say is that for Vladimir Putin, there is no such thing as a win-win situation. It's either, you know, I win, you lose, or you lose and I win.
Again, I mean, I think this is all ongoing and happening so quickly, it's presumptuous for anyone to explain what the actual thinking is on the part of Putin. What I would say, though, is, again, it's helpful to have these frames of references, right? If this is about a greater Russia strategy, where the idea is that Putin, over the course of his remaining time in power, would like to repatriate as much territory from the old former Soviet Union as he can get away with into Russia, then that suggests one set of outcomes. If, on the other hand, it's about a security concern, then I think we have to wonder, you know, from Putin's position, what did he see as the best strategy for enhancing his security in this particular area?
And that was taking Crimea and not even trusting that this interim government, which he considers illegitimate, would take his interests into consideration.
Well, clearly at this point, it looks like what the Russians wanted was, before they got into any discussions with anybody, is to have in their hip pocket this vote with overwhelming support for the first option on the referendum, the decision to reunite with Russia. But there still may absolutely be the possibility that this is part of a calculated, negotiated strategy. You know, there's the United States and Guantanamo Bay. There are issues where superior military forces have military installations that are guaranteed by treaty and other places. And so you and I can look at the situation and say, oh, immediately afterwards, you know, what was there really to fear about the Black Sea Fleet? But perhaps, you know, there was uncertainty about the intentions of the Ukrainian government. Again, I think the only thing I would say here is that just because this vote has taken place, I don't think we can conclude that that's definitive evidence that all Putin cares about is annexing territory to Russia. Similarly, just because the vote has taken place doesn't mean that Putin has concluded that he would never talk to the new Ukrainian government. It may be that this was seen as a way of showing a signal to domestic constituents in Russia just how seriously Putin takes this issue, while at the same time improving negotiation standards moving forward. I think it's also important to say another sort of factor I think that we need to think about here is what the overthrow of Yanukovych means within the Russian context. What we saw here was a mass-based movement, popular uprising in the capital that overthrew a government in Yanukovych that bore similarities to the government that is running Russia right now. Another possibility here is that what happened in Ukraine, again, this would be viewing it from more from a domestic Russian perspective, that what happened in Ukraine is seen as a threat to the style of rule in Russia right now, what we could loosely call Putinism. The images of the leader on the run out of the country with the leader's residence being opened up for everyone to see and for pictures to spread over social media of all the opulence and the wealth that was connected, we have to ask whether that was seen as being threatening to the Russian regime as well. And perhaps what's most important here is showing that this is not an option for Russia moving forward. If that's the case, then I think it shifts the emphasis away from these sort of greater Russia scenarios that people are talking about, with this being a situation where the big question is expansion of Russian territory, to this being a calculated effort to show that these types of events that happen in Ukraine are not going to be long-term successful. And that implies that the longer-term goal here may be to destabilize the Ukrainian regime, to show to the Ukrainian people and to show to the Russian people that this is, becomes difficult for the Ukrainian people. So I think there's multi-layered interactions going on here where we want to keep in mind the relationship between Putin and his domestic constituents in Russia, Putin and his domestic opponents in Russia, Putin and sort of immediate security concerns brought about by what happened in Ukraine, and Putin and what may be seen as longer-range security goals.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Joshua Tucker. He's a professor of politics at New York University and a co-director of the NYU Social Media and Political Participation Laboratory. And I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com and click on podcasts. Joshua, before we get into social media, just have one quick last question to you with respect to this crisis. How do you think the West has been responding with economic sanctions, both from the EU and the United States? Will this affect Putin, his calculations, and what is the possibility of retaliation by the Russian regime?
I think clearly, given the situation on the ground, the location of Ukraine, the fact that Ukraine is not a member of NATO, the fact that Russian troops are very close to Ukraine, inside parts of Ukraine right now. In the short term, it's very hard for the United States and the West to be able to deter Russians from doing what they want on their border. However, in the longer term, I think it's important to realize that we're not in the same place we were 20 years ago or during the Cold War. The global economy is a global economy. Russia makes a tremendous amount of money over the sale of natural resources, in particular gas and oil, and a lot of that goes to Western Europe. In the longer term, to the extent that Russia is frozen out of global international economic interactions, this has the potential to be painful for Russian economic growth. It has the potential to be painful for Russia's economic development. So I think that the reactions of the West are exactly what we would expect the West to do in this case. to use the levers that it has at its disposal. So I think one of the questions becomes, is there sustained attention to this reaction, or is this something that fades quickly as soon as the matter is no longer the most important in the news cycle?
Fascinating discussion, and we'll be talking for quite a while about the crisis in Ukraine. But let's turn now to the use of social media as a tool to facilitate protests, such as that which occurred in Maidan in Ukraine, and as a tool to push for change. Of course, we have a lot of evidence from the Arab Spring uprisings, which were largely driven by Twitter and Facebook, to Ukraine, even Turkey, and of course now Venezuela we're seeing. How central do you think has the use of social media been to these political crises? And can we say that without these tools, the protests would not have had anywhere near the impact that they have had?
What I think we can conclusively say is that the nature of protest and the way that protest emerges is changing because of social media. Does that mean that these events would not have taken place without social media? Absolutely not. But does it mean that there are dynamics to protest in the social media era that may be different from what we've seen before? Absolutely. And I think one of the features of this is that we've now seen in the last 2 years, just count on your hands how many unexpected protests that emerge where people didn't expect to see them. We've seen this in Brazil. We saw this most dramatically, perhaps, in Turkey. We've seen this in Ukraine. And I think what's going on here with social media is a couple different things. One is it is allowing what we might call leaderless protests to emerge much, much easier. You can now get information out to people in a much simpler way than you were able to prior to the social media era. Moreover, people are receiving this information in a fundamentally different manner. And what I mean by that is that people are now getting information about political events, not just from the media, not just from television or newspapers, but from social networks that they themselves have chosen to join, either by following people on Twitter or Instagram, or by becoming friends with someone on Facebook or signing up to follow a political movement on Facebook. But when you self-select into these organizations, you are saying, hey, I value this in some way or another. And we're seeing information that can then flow through these organizations. These are organizations that don't need to have a physical presence prior to disseminating this information. And moreover, one of the big issues with protest on the part of individuals, when individuals want to think about taking to the streets, is always thinking, well, what's the value of my action if nobody else does this? Well, when you go to a Facebook page and you can see that 40,000 people have already signed up to like a Facebook page, that's a really powerful signal. When you see a really good friend of yours saying, I'm going to go to this protest, and meanwhile, 500 people have liked that statement, that's a signal, which is different from just talking to someone in the hall, right? Moreover, we know, for example, during Turkey, that people were deliberately using social media in real time to target their friends and say, hey, you have to come join us. You have to come out here and be part of this. So I think what we're seeing is the ability to go from, in the older days where you might have thought in order to get protests, you would need more long-scale organization, more long-standing hierarchical organizations that exist. It becomes much easier for people to sort of form these movements when the opportunity presents itself, or when these movements decide that they're going to try to get people out of the online world into the offline world onto the streets, it can happen much faster. One really interesting thing that we found when we were studying the use of social media in the Euromaidan protests was that it looked like people were using different platforms for different purposes. So Facebook was being used during the Euromaidan protest for information. What are the needs on the Maidan right now? What do doctors do on the Maidan? How do you get on buses to get into Kiev? Facebook was serving, and we can see this by the use of the Ukrainian language, as a means of communicating information, as bulletin boards, as ways to find out stuff. Twitter, on the other hand, a lot of tweets were in English about these protests. So that serves as a way to sort of get international attention, communicate to the outside world that's going on. We also see huge spikes in Twitter usage every time there's one of the big events in the Euromaidan. So in real time, Twitter has this ability to notify people as developments as they're going on the ground. The other really interesting thing that we found was that at the time of each of these big sort of spikes in activity in Twitter and the Euromaidan, we also found more people signing up for new Twitter accounts who would then subsequently tweet about the protests. So it seems like there's a symbiotic relationship going on here where social media is being used to get information out to people about what's going on, but people are also turning to social media when the protests take place. Social media can also play an important role when national media or more traditional forms of media like television aren't providing coverage to protest movements. So we saw this most dramatically in Turkey when famously CNN International was airing information about the protests and CNN Turkey was airing a documentary about penguins. And right. So what ended up happening was social media was used to fill a hole. And the protesters adopted penguins as symbols of what they were doing. But this, I think, is a very strong development because whereas prior social media and prior internet communications generally, there may have been concerns about the ability of state-sponsored media to sort of shut down and close down communication, social media opens up a way around that. Now, just to be caveat about that, regimes are, of course, aware of this. So what we're also witnessing here is this ongoing development of a cat and mouse game where people who are protesting are trying to figure out how to use social media to protest, and regimes are also trying to use social media to figure out what their best strategies are for responding to these protests.
Well, exactly. I wanted to ask you about that, how regimes are retaliating by either shutting down the internet or trying to close the space for that type of social media. How successful have they been, and how dangerous is that to the use of social media for the protests?
Well, you know, this is very much ongoing and evolving, and this is something that we're also trying to study to try to get a handle on how this is going. I think the most research has been done, of course, on the Great Firewall of China, right, where China is trying to actively manage what's happening in the internet sphere with armies of censors who get involved with what can be posted and what cannot be posted and what needs to be taken down. And there's been some very interesting research done on this by Professor Gary King at Harvard University and his colleagues there, Jen Pan and Molly Roberts, looking at the strategies and what it is that the Chinese regime tries to censor. We've also seen where the government will sponsor its own bloggers and its own tweeters and get people onto social media platforms to try to put out pro-regime messages. So we can see that's another strategy that can be taken. There's also what's known as hashtag wars, where you can have a hashtag that's being used for an opposition movement, but then you get lots of people trying to take over and use that exact same hashtag to put pro-regime messages out there or anti-opposition messages out there. There's also, of course, the omnipresent fear that social media will be used to target individual protesters, that by leaving behind a digital record of who's organizing what in the opposition, that the regime, just as scholars can use that information to try to study how protest is happening, that other forces will be able to use that information to track down who was involved.
Do we have evidence of that so far in any of these countries?
I don't know at this point in time. I'm not the right person to ask about that. You know, there is stuff that has been written about what happened in Iran in the aftermath of the 2009 protests and whether Facebook pictures were used to sort of go after people. But I can't speak definitively to that one way or another. But I think what we can say at this point is that this is an evolving interaction. And I think it would be a terrible mistake to read this as something that will unambiguously help people in struggles against regimes, right? And that opposition movements, that this is a two-way game,
right?
And that regimes are very much aware of what's going on with social media and trying to figure out how to use this. But on the other hand, we don't see full-scale shutting down of the internet very often at all happening anywhere. And there are physical reasons where it can be harder to do this in some countries than others. You know, there are a lot of people on Facebook who are doing things that are not political at all. So you suddenly shut down Facebook in a situation and you've incurred the wrath of a lot of other people.
Sort of like cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Right. I mean, I think this is an ongoing situation where everyone's trying to figure out what the next move is. Especially interesting about it is that technology is, of course, playing a huge role in this. I mean, a few years ago, we wouldn't have been sitting here talking about Twitter's role in this because Twitter didn't exist. And there's a continuum of political action here where social media is affecting this. I mean, we're talking about protest, which is a particular form of political action. But we also know that social media is being utilized for things such as turnout and get out the vote. We had this huge effort on the Obama campaign in 2012 to try to get more people to the polling booths using Facebook, using social media, and we will continue to see this all over the world because many, many people take notice of this.
Also, we're seeing it being used as a negotiating tool. For example, leaders like Secretary of State John Kerry or President Rouhani of Iran posting their positions on Twitter and so forth. How much of an impact is this having, and to what extent is this tool not superseding but certainly complementing the traditional tools of diplomacy?
This is totally fascinating to me. I mean, one of the things we saw in Ukraine was that Yatsenyuk, one of the opposition leaders, rejected an offer from Yanukovych, the Ukrainian president, during the ongoing negotiations during the Euromaidan protests. He actually rejected an offer on Twitter. And the way, what was fascinating about this was that he rejected the offer on Twitter in English. Now, a lot of what he posts is in Ukrainian, but this was in English. Well, what ended up happening? 3 hours later, on the New York Times website, is the exact text, word for word, of what Yatsenyuk said in his tweet. So this has got to be an understanding. You can manage your message when you are able to directly put out exactly what you're saying in a forum where lots of people are saying it, in a language where you want it reported internationally. And this is an incredibly interesting tool and an interesting development. And you think about that situation. I mean, going out and holding a press conference in the middle of a protest is difficult. Being able to tweet throughout an event and getting your message out there for journalists to then report much to the wider audience. And I think the fact that this announcement was made in English, not Ukrainian, is indicative of just how people are beginning to think about this.
Indeed. Well, one more question, Joshua Tucker. And that is, to what extent are you monitoring interaction among protesters in different countries? Like, I read where the Venezuelan protesters were in touch with their Ukrainian counterparts, trying to emulate their techniques and methods.
This is a fascinating area. And I think this is a much larger question, which is, as we get in a more globalized world, are we going to see more and more spillover across movements? We talked about the colored revolutions as being a set of movements that took place in the post-communist space. And then there was the question, well, is this spreading to Lebanon, when we talked about the Cedar Revolution and these sorts of things? The question then becomes, as technology makes it easier and easier for more people to be in communication, how much that will happen passively? Just that Ukrainians in the Maidan are leaving behind images and records of what they did online, and how much of it will actually happen more actively with, for example, the use of hashtags like OWS or Occupy, which were used all over the world with people trying to adopting the same framework, the same types of hashtags in order to facilitate more of the spread of communication. But I think to think that this is not going to happen more is mistaken. This information is out there. People can access it. And when people are watching people in other countries doing what they want to do, the idea that these ties can develop without ever having had face-to-face contact, I think is a really interesting development for how we think about the spread of these movements.
Joshua Tucker is a professor of politics and Russian and Slavic studies at New York University and a co-director of the NYU Social Media and Political Participation Laboratory. Well, Joshua, thank you so much for your time and terrific insights.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington and New York City. Our engineer was Gary Jaffe. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.